This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable. All right, everybody, this is the Western Rookie Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson. And if this is your first episode, man, I really appreciate it. Welcome, welcome. Today's guest, Mr. Aaron Berg. Aaron, how we doing, man?
All right, we're doing great.
Doing good.
Cool to be on here with you, Dan.
I appreciate your time today, man. Lately, I've been, across all the podcasts that I host, I've been trying to just like dig deep into like the average Joe type conversations. I mean, I feel like so often you get some big giant name in there who has different resources, who has like, I consider what I have a full-time job, but let's be honest, dude, like it's not a real job compared to like the factory dude or the cubicle guy or the guy who's laying concrete every day. You know, it's not a real job compared to that. I've just kind of set my life up to, I don't know, have a little more fun. I don't know. I probably don't make as much money as those guys, but I wanted to get into like these conversations that I'm about to have with you because I feel they're so realistic. They're more relatable than having some guy who gets to spend 30 days out of his year in a mountain or in the woods somewhere chasing an animal. So thank you for your time, man. What do you do for a living?
I'm in sales. So right now I'm doing roughing sales. Mm-hmm. So do that. And then I do aerial inspections with my drone and then also do thermal recovery in the fall.
Oh, so you have like a little business where you will, you know, some guy's like, hey, dude, I just gut shot a giant. Can you help me find him? Type of deal.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's a lot of fun in the fall doing that.
Yeah. Get you outside. Like,
yeah, how one gets me outside all night long and my wife loves it.
Yeah, your wife loves it. Out of curiosity, man, how much money do you make a year running a drone and recovering deer for people?
Not as much as you would think. Okay. You know, it costs so much to get into it because, mm-hmm. you know, the actual good drones cost so much. You know, right now I'm running probably a $15,000 unit.
Holy shit.
So you got to spend a little bit. So the actual, you know, true profit isn't all that high, but you make 30-ish a year.
30 grand?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I mean, I think
don't go buy one, Dan.
No, I'm just, what I'm getting at is like 30K a year. I mean, that's a big investment for a $15,000 drone and then 30K return on investment in a year. Man, my wife would be, if I provided another 30 grand to the family every year because I was gone at night, I don't think my wife would give a shit. She'd be like, oh, dude, yeah, you want to be gone all night and bring in that kind of, you know, that additional income? Okay, go for it. Go for it. But how many deer recoveries do you go on every year?
All depends on the year. You know, there's some days you get none, and the next day you've got seven or eight people that are calling or texting you. Mm-hmm. Then you're gone all night and recharging batteries at a truck stop or a gas station trying to keep the drone in the air all afternoon.
Yeah. Is there a higher percentage recovery rate for drones versus dogs?
I would say, yeah. The only time that the drone is really an issue is if you're in conifers. You know, if you're in a cedar swamp and everything's bedded under where you can't find a thermal image, then the drones are basically useless. But outside of that, I mean, you find every squirrel and every quail and every pheasant and every deer.
That's badass, dude. What have you learned from a how, like, just animal standpoint? What have you learned about animals since you started running this drone looking for deer?
I think the biggest thing that I've learned is that the where you hunt is very important. Flying a drone on one of my spots last year, where I had, you know, good bucks every single day, multiple times a day running through this pinch point. And I hit one bad last year and flew the drone up on that. And there were five deer in the 100 acres that I was hunting on. It just happened that every single one of those five deer was walking past that trail camera every day.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, there actually aren't very many here.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're saying
how they work through the landscape.
Okay. And you're saying that where you hunt, there's less deer per acre or whatever than what you initially thought.
Yeah. I thought that the place was filthy with them until I flew the drone on it. And it's like, oh, I guess I have a good spot.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So that's very interesting. I'd love to, find out a little more information about some of the other stuff that you see. Like, what's the craziest thing you've ever witnessed when you've been looking for, like, have you ever seen any hillbillies in the woods cooking meth or something like that? No,
no, okay. No, sadly nothing crazy like that. Oh, okay. You know, you see some cool critters running around. Saw Fisher last year. We followed him around with the drone for a while, which is neat to see.
Oh, that's
we
crazy.
Don't have many of those up by me.
Yeah. Awesome. Awesome. All right. Well, this is the Western Rookie Podcast. And so we're going to talk a little bit about some of your Western adventures. But before we do, I want to send a huge shout out to the partners of the Western Rookie Podcast. First, we're going to talk a little bit about Montana Decoy. Montana Decoy is a new partner to the Western Rookie Podcast. And whether you're looking to get inside the quote unquote kill zone or the bubble of an antelope, a whitetail, an elk, mule deer, Montana Decoy has a decoy for you. They're lightweight. They're packable, very packable. You can crumple them down into, you know, the size of a softball if you wanted to. And then you pop them up real quick and you make your stock and you're good to go. So go check out MontanaDecoy.com. Next on the list is Wasp Archery, WaspArchery.com. You can go check out their full lineup of mechanical and fixed blade broadheads. I've been shooting Wasp broadheads now for, really close to 20 years. I can remember taking maybe a season off a long time ago to try a new head, and then I just kept coming back to Wasp. Most of their heads are still manufactured in the United States. Go check out WaspArchery.com. I do have a discount code NFC20. For 20% off, and go get them, go pick them up. All right. What is your Western hunting experience so far?
So far I've done two elk hunts out West. So I did a Montana hunt when I was in my early 20s that I probably couldn't afford then and shouldn't have done in the first place. and then I took about a decade off of that. And then went to Utah last year on an elk hunt. And then the better part of a decade now, we've been going out to Nebraska every year hunting, sometimes mule deer if we get a tag for them, otherwise whitetails.
Yeah. How many years have you hunted mule deer in Nebraska?
So I've had tags that allowed for mule deer for 4 years. Okay. But I've shot two mule deer out there.
Okay. And this is obviously Western Nebraska where mule deer live, correct?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. I want to get into the elk here in a little bit, but for me, every time I hunted mule deer in Nebraska, it was difficult. I mean, it was difficult to locate them. Every time I was out there, it was extremely dry. So, and I'm not sure, maybe I was looking in the wrong spots, but the water was always on private land. And so private land, if you had the water, then you had the animals. And so a lot of the public was heavily grazed and no real water other than maybe some cattle tanks that were on it. And maybe they were on, maybe they were off. Maybe the cattle were there, maybe they weren't. If the cattle weren't there, then they shut them off and then the wildlife would go away. So talk to me a little bit about your mule deer experience in Western Nebraska.
Yeah, I mean, when mule deer were the first few years that I went out there. So, I mean, we had no idea what we were doing in the first place. Right. And so, our strategy the first year was just put on miles, just walk and look and glass and, you know, get up high wherever you could. And I think it was like the third or fourth day that I was there on my first trip, I actually ran into another group of guys from Wisconsin.
Okay.
And I was chatting with them. They had both shot deer earlier in the week. And they had actually turned me on to checking out these little like plum thickets. I don't know if you're familiar with that brush out there in the western Nebraska. But, you know, it was nothing but grass forever. And then you get these little thickets of, you know, 8 to 10 foot tall brush in these corners on the northwestern slopes. So what we ended up doing is, you know, just looking at Google Maps, you know, at that point I didn't even have OnX on my phone. You know, we were using the Avenza maps for the areas we were in. And, you know, we were just locating all these little thickets and essentially just trying to scent bump each one. You'd get within 100 or 150 yards and just walk downwind of each one and try and push deer out. That actually worked really, really well for
us. Was that with a rifle or with archery equipment?
That was with a rifle.
Rifle. Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. All right. And so when you bumped them, did they just rocket out of there or did they just kind of stand up and catch your scent and then kind of mosey off?
Yeah. So they would pop out and generally they'd go 10 or 15 yards and stop and look and try and figure out what was going on.
Yeah. I don't know if it was a quote unquote plum thicket because I don't know the vegetation, but when I was in Nebraska, the first year I ever went to Nebraska looking for mule deer and antelope, I had both tags that year. Everything was in those little thickets that were in all of the drainages where like thorn bushes and maybe these plum thickets, and that's where everything was bedded. Except for, you know, obviously the antelope, they weren't there every single, you know, every day. But if there was any type of cover, any trees, any bush, there was deer in that, in or around that, as close or deep as into it as possible. So,
yeah, and that's exactly what we saw out there too. It's just, if you had cover, there were does bedded in there. And Nebraska's rifle season, I mean, it's the second week of November. So, I mean, it is a rut hunt in every way, shape, and form. So, like, if you bump enough spots with does, you're going to find bucks eventually.
Yeah. And that's kind of, that's a crazy method too, where it's just like, dude, here's what we're going to go do. We're just going to cause a shit ton of chaos. We're going to let them know we're here. We're going to try to get them to stand up and we're going to shoot them from, you know, how far were the shots usually?
I mean, I shot the first one was 65 yards.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And the second one was a little over 300 that I shot out there. But I mean, you know, I'm going out to, you know, the flat plains. So, I mean, I had a 13 pound rifle with me with a giant scope and I'm trying to offhand shoot at 65 yards. It's like, oh God, I might've planned a little wrong for how we ended up doing this.
Right. Okay. And is that still a hunt you guys do today?
Yep. We go every year.
Rifle?
We do a rifle. Last year, I actually drew an archery tag out there. Mm-hmm. So I went out 5 days early, to get 5 good days of archery hunting.
Yeah.
Reason being is after we had shot our bucks a couple years ago, we just did some extra scouting in the area and, you know, looking around, and we found this little pinch point that, I mean, it looked like a cattle trail going through this area, but there was no cattle grazed. It was like, there's one tree in the corner of this little swamp that I figured I could get in. Cause you know, you go to a state like Nebraska with no trees and the Wisconsinite in me is like, I need to get up there.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
but was able to set up there and first night shot a 3.5-year-old 10 pointer out of that corner.
Dude. Awesome. Awesome. And so talk to me a little bit about, so I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Nebraska has changed their regulations over the past handful of years, because I'm almost positive you could get a deer tag over the counter for a non-resident and just show up, grab a, and you could hunt mule deer or whitetails with that. Has that changed recently to where it's species specific now?
Yeah, I don't remember what year it changed. It's been a few years now since they went away from everybody getting an either species tag. So now they give out a few either species tags and then everybody else is getting whitetail tags and they have a draw system set up now. It's still essentially over the counter. The draw system, I mean, I think it's $7 to do an application. And the first year they did it, we didn't draw a tag and we're freaking out like, oh my God, what are we going to do for our Western hunt this year? And it turns out there were 1,500 leftover tags for the area we were hunting anyway. So we just essentially had over-the-counter tags.
Yeah. And so it was like North Dakota used to be, where all you had to do was apply. And for that point, it was a South Dakota. I don't know what I said. South Dakota. And you're guaranteed a tag. I mean, as long as you applied, you're getting a tag. They weren't turning away people. But now they've reduced numbers to non-residents. And there's people having to get their preference points now in order to hunt some of those states. So with that said, did you guys hunt mule deer like only, and then now because of the rules and regulations have switched to whitetails?
For the most part, I mean, the allure of going to Nebraska when we started was that we could hunt for mule deer. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the closest state that we can go to and have a chance at them. Mm-hmm. But like you were saying, there's not a lot. They're hard to find. And you know, we would get one or two chances or opportunities each year. But that was it.
Yeah.
We're now focusing more on whitetails. We have a lot more opportunities and you see a lot more critters.
Yeah. Are you going as deep because you're focusing on whitetails? Are you going as deep into Nebraska or are you staying closer?
We're doing like central Nebraska. Gotcha. I mean, there's still some mule deer around, but because the tags are so hard to get for mule deer, it's a little bit easier just to focus on those. And then with the archery permits there, they actually only give up 5,000 archery permits for the entire state
For non-residents, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So there's way less pressure for the archery season, which was fun to see.
Yeah, I believe that, dude. Anytime, and you know, more states are going to that. More states are reducing tags for non-residents. And I think what it's going to do is, I mean, let's not kid ourselves. It sucks, but it's going to make the hunting better. You ask any hunter, would you prefer a tag every year or would you prefer a shit ton of hunting pressure? Right? Like exactly what Colorado did, right? Every time I talk to someone on this podcast or on the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast about Colorado and elk hunting, it's dude, pressure. Oh, dude, I saw so many hunters. Reduction. You're not hunting every year, but people are like, dude, the hunting was more fun. It was better. I liked it more. I'm okay with missing a year or two in order to go have a better hunt in 3 years as opposed to every year. So I think a lot of states are going to start doing, you know, the trend is that already, but, you know, a lot of states are going to be following suit to that too. So, and I love Nebraska, man. I have some family that lives in central Nebraska, cattle farming family. And I had the opportunity once to go stay at their house and hunt every morning out of that and, come back when it got hot or it started raining. And dude, I had a blast out there. It was all private and they owned a ton of ground. And I missed an antelope and I saw some good whitetail bucks, not a lot of mule deer, but dude, I had an absolute blast hunting Nebraska, dude.
Yeah. I mean, we love it. We've got buddies that live out there. And we got a buddy that lives like 45 minutes from where we hunt. So it makes life a little bit easier for the trip because we camp out there.
Yeah.
You know, being able to go over to our buddy's house and shower and get dinner, you know, midweek or like this past year. I mean, I shot that buck on day one of a 10-day hunt. So I was able to go over there and get my deer in the freezer and get everything broken down. So it was logistically, it made life a little bit easier for me.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's a hunt you guys do every year.
Yep. And it's gone. I mean, it's trended a little bit differently these past few years. We have a section that we really, really like to hunt that we see a ton of deer in now relative to what we used to. So normally we're going to kill our bucks on day one or two of the season. And now we bring a canoe and all of our duck stuff. And so, I mean, we get our deer and then we just focus on duck hunting for the rest of the week. So it makes it a really cool trip that way.
Yeah. Hell yeah. Talk to me a little bit about, cause I have my own experience or my own opinions about Western whitetails. And a lot of people, especially if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably not focused on, whitetail hunting, right? You're going west to hunt elk, antelope, or mule deer, top three, right? Those are probably the top three, maybe some bear hunters out there, but, Western whitetails, dude, they are a very unique creature compared to the Midwest. What's your, you know, what have you seen from deer behavior of a Western whitetail?
I mean, they're interesting on how they use the landscape relative to what they do in the Midwest states, you know, cause we think of deer on, you know, a 40 or an 80 or 100 acre pieces, you know, they bed right here. They feed right here. They have their water source. We're out west. I mean, they're using such vast amounts of land every day. I mean, you're watching these deer cruise for miles, and that could just be because we can actually see them out there. Right. You know, they might be doing the same thing at home, but you can't tell.
Yeah.
We're out there. I mean, you're watching them go over these hills and, you know, go 3, 4, 5 miles between bedding areas. Out there, it just seems like you just need to be able to see.
Yeah.
Like the more you can see, the better chances you have out there. But you know, I've put myself in the position plenty of times throughout the years where I get up high to see and it's like, oh, well, they're exactly where I thought they were going to be in that little thicket down here. And now I'm 600 yards away and 200 feet above them.
Yeah.
And you got to try and scurry down this hill and get in position. And by the time you get there, your heart rate is at 190 and you're trying to make a shot.
Yeah. I thought, you know, any weapon, dude, I just like spotting and stalking out there, bedded mule deer, or when I go to South Dakota and I'm trying to shoot a mule deer out there. Holy shit, dude, my heart rate is jumping through my chest and I'm trying to hold myself together while I see antler tips, or, you know, I can see their back and I'm trying to just get over the hill, balance in a weird way and have my bow at full draw. And yeah, I 100% get that. So, one thing I've noticed about Western whitetails is they do not give you a second chance. Like, let's say a Midwestern, whitetail would. They see you gone. Like they're gone and they run until you can't even see them anymore. Like until your eyes stop working. And a mule deer may bound off a little bit, look back a couple times. Midwestern whitetail, sometimes they'll even let you drive right by them in a truck, but that's not the case for the whitetails that I've seen out west. All right, guys, you know me, and I love eating wild game, but I don't eat wild game every single night. Every once in a while, I'll reach for a side of beef, and that's why I trust Omaha Steaks. Because Omaha Steaks are sent directly to my door, I can keep my freezer stocked without having to go to the grocery store. It's honestly like having a trusted butcher and gourmet food shop right at your house. Last week, I pulled out their pure ground ribeye burgers for a quick grill session. The flavor and marbling was unreal, rich, juicy, and miles ahead of any average grocery store meat. Try the Burger Perfection Flight at omahasteaks.com today. That's 20 premium steak burgers for just $79.99. Plus, get $35 off with promo code BEEF. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code BEEF for $35 off at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details.
No, that's exactly the same as what I've seen. Yeah. Once they're spooked, they are gone
forever. You never see them again. You might see them in a different state, but they're gone. That's how far they're running. Okay. And it sounds like you've had some fun. You've had some success with that rifle hunt throughout the years. You said about a decade ago, you were a young whippersnapper and you said, hey, I want to go to Montana on an elk hunt. Talk to me a little bit about that hunt specifically and why all of a sudden this, you know, like, dude, I want to go to Montana on an elk hunt.
Yeah. I mean, I'd always liked the idea of elk hunting. You know, you watch the videos and the YouTube stuff and you're like, God, it looks unbelievable out there. Just the scenery and going after these monstrous animals. And I was a charter boat captain at the time. And one of my customers actually invited me to go with him. He had been going to this lodge forever. So it was a lodge based hunt, but it was all on public ground. And the guy I went with, I mean, I think he was like 73 or 74 at the time. And so me being 25, I'm like, I'll be just fine out in the mountains with this guy. Like it won't be an issue. But I was a charter captain. I smoked all day. And I got out there and it just beat the tar out of me.
I mean,
I'm trying to follow a senior citizen through the mountains and I can't keep up. And I'm like, oh God, this is bad. At the time, I didn't have the money. I probably shouldn't have done the hunt in the first place. But with Montana, you know, the tag was, you know, $800 or whatever it is for a bull tag out there. And the combo tag was like $1,100. And I was too poor to be like, I can spend the extra $300. Yeah. And of course, I mean, we got into mule deer every day. I mean, I could have shot mule deer bucks every single day of that trip.
Yeah.
And so that was a big reminder in my mind. Like now when we go out west, it's like you get tags for whatever you can possibly get because you never know when you're going to run into a good opportunity.
Yeah, that's a fact. That's a fact. Was this another rifle tag hunt?
Archery. This was archery hunting.
Okay, archery. Yep. And so did you have, I mean, it was out of a lodge, so you didn't need like a tent or any like water purification system or anything like that. Was this essentially a guided hunt, or did you just stay at the lodge and then they let you go wherever you wanted to?
Yeah, no, we just stayed at the lodge and just went wherever we felt like that day. But, you know, they made you the food. And so, yeah, it was an easy introductory into Western hunting because you didn't need all of the gear and all the preparation. Yeah. You just drove 27 hours and got there. And, you know, it's like, all right, well, now we're in the mountains. Let's go find some elk.
Exactly. And once you got there, did you find some elk?
It took a few days. We did get into the elk. Like the fourth day out there, we had some snow that came in and we were able to spot some up high.
Yeah.
It was a 4-hour hike to get up to where they were at. And did have a spike bull that came in to 9 yards. I mean, he almost ran me over, but it was in an area where it had to be a branch antlered bull to be legal.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was the most exciting thing that had ever happened to me. You know, you're sitting there, you're calling, and then all of a sudden you just see an antler tip coming through, you know, down the mountain, just crashing through, and you're like, holy crap, it's going to work. Like, this is going to happen. And it comes down, and you're like, oh, God, it's a spike. Like,
yeah. What elevation were you hunting at, if you can remember that?
I want to say that we were at about 8,000 feet.
8,000 feet. So still high enough to where you're feeling the impacts of elevation.
Yep. And like I said, just not being used to it, not having any preparation prior to going out there. And, you know, I live at 750 feet.
Right.
So, yeah, you get out there and it hits you pretty hard. But that was really the only day that we got into elk. The guy I was with was pretty shot by that point, honestly. So was I. So trying to do another 4-hour hike the next morning to get back up into him was kind of out of the cards for us.
Yeah. Yeah. And so what was the end result of that hunt? Was it just like cool experience type of takeaway? It was like,
this is neat. I need to prepare more. I need to get my body where it needs to be. And if I ever want to try to do the real Western hunting.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel that. Okay. So fast forward 10 years, you got the bug again to go out West. What kicked this one off? This, cause where did you go? Where'd you decide to go to?
I went out to Utah.
Utah. Okay. Tell us why Utah, why 10 years later going on another hunt, and why not hunting elk or another Western, you know, hunting elk in between that 10 years?
I just didn't have the funds to do it. You know, these trips can be expensive, and wanting to do more of the DIY stuff. Mm-hmm. You need so much more gear and so much more preparation to get out there. I went with like a drop camp outfitter this year.
Okay.
And so that made some of it a little bit.
Outfitter.
So like they have the big, tent set up and like a big base camp.
Yep.
So that was nice. We ended up spike camping for the majority of it, but it was nice to have a base camp that you could go back to at least if you needed to.
Okay.
Honestly, I brought it up to my wife, and then we were trying to draw a different tag, didn't draw it. And then my wife was like, well, why don't you go on that Utah hunt that you talked about, you know, 6 months ago? And when she said that, I said, okay. Like, if your wife tells you to go on the elk hunt, you go on the elk hunt.
Right. Right. What was the tag allocation process like for Utah?
So I hunted on a spike cow tag.
Okay.
most of Utah is pretty tough to draw if you want, like, their trophy bowl units.
Right.
You know, non-residents just aren't getting those tags, but they're pretty liberal with your spike and cow tags. So I just want to shoot an elk. You know, I don't care big, small, in between. Like, I just want the experience of being out in the mountains and getting into elk. So it was a great opportunity, and the tags weren't that expensive. I think, again, they were about $800 for that tag.
For that tag. And it was good for a spike bull or a cow.
Yep. Yep. Right. So basically, yeah. So the majority of the elk on the mountain, you could shoot with it.
Okay, cool. All right. And so, you know, you learned your lesson last time. You were not physically prepared for that hunt. Talk to me a little bit about how you prepared for this hunt.
A billion miles of rucking.
Okay.
I like that. I have a 2-year-old, so yeah. I would throw him in the backpack, you know, a little kid carrying backpack, yeah. And we would go hike around at home. And when I didn't have him, then I would just throw 50 pounds of sand in the bag and do that. And I think I did 175 miles last summer.
Oh, really?
With weight on my back.
Yeah.
And then that, I was running quite a bit. I did a half marathon this spring. So just trying to get everything dialed in. And honestly, I've felt great in the mountains this year.
Awesome. Were you still chain smoking at that point?
No.
Okay.
I quit that. I think it was my second year in Nebraska I stopped smoking, because even in Nebraska I was getting my butt kicked.
Yeah.
And my hunting partner weighs 100 pounds more than me, and he was kicking my butt. And I'm like, okay, well, maybe I should probably stop this.
Yeah. Maybe it's these SIGs are not the best idea. I get it. Okay.
Yep. And when you look at yourself and, you know, you're 27 years old and you can't do the stuff that you want, it's a pretty eye-opening experience. Like, okay, like this is going to cause problems throughout my life. And so that was time to quit that.
I will say this though. I am simply amazed by the way that some people treat their bodies with food or cigarettes or alcohol. And they live till they're 90 years old and there's no problems, right? It's just like, and then you got people who is like, oh, well, I got lung cancer because I smoked for 10 years or whatever the case is. And so I don't know why I'm bringing this up. It's just like, I know a couple of some guys I know, their dads are in their late 70s, early 80s, and they just are still smoking a pack of cigarettes a day. They still drink beer, like every night. And I'm just blown away because I can't do that. I can't even do that shit today at 45, and they're doing it at, you know, in their late 70s. So it's probably still better to not do those things. But okay. You rucked tons of miles. I have also found that the best thing to do is simulate what you're going to be doing up in the mountains. And that's walking up and down big hills or side hilling. And, that's what I did. When I had my best years in Colorado, when I was the most physically fit, I was putting anywhere between 45 to 75, 80 pounds on my pack and just hiking on the trails, in these state parks that were by my house. And that gave me the best results straight up. Not any lifting program, not any type of like full body workouts, just shooting my bow, eating healthy and rucking a million miles.
Yep. Yep. Same. Cause I live up by the Kettle Moraines in Wisconsin. I mean, it's the hilliest stuff that we have basically in our area. And so, I mean, you just pound miles going up and down these hills. And I mean, it simulates exactly what we're trying to do out west, except you're 8,000 feet below it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. All right. So let's talk a little bit about the tag then was, because it was for a spike bull or a cow, it was easy to get. Did you go through the outfitter to get it, or did you have to pick it up yourself?
I had to go through it myself.
Okay.
All right. But it was a simple process to get the tag. I might go out there again this year. I haven't decided. I applied for an antelope tag in Wyoming. So if I don't draw that, we'll find out in, I think, 2 weeks on that.
Gotcha.
But if I don't draw that, then I'll probably end up in Utah again. Like I said, it was a fun hunt. It's early in the year, so we were there the last week of August.
Oh, wow. Was it hot?
yeah, they, so their archery season actually starts, I believe, August 15th mm-hmm. for elk. And it runs through the first week of September. Then it closes. So you don't really get a true rut hunt in Utah with an archery tag.
Really? Do they do a muzzleloader season in that time frame?
They have a muzzleloader. They have a relatively early rifle season.
Okay. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. In most other states, their rifle seasons don't start until, late September or even early October.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. And so, so the tag was $800-ish. What was the outfitter fee for getting you and your gear up to this? And then did you go with a guide every day?
No.
Okay.
So it was an interesting spot. I had heard about it on a different podcast. I think he was on Remy's podcast at one point. So they did an elk school kind of thing where they have some guides, and for the first couple of days you're out glassing with guides and going through different scenarios. It's a great program for people who have never elk hunted or have never done any of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And then the last half of the week, the last 4 days, you're out on your own to kind of do whatever you want or see whatever you want.
Okay.
So I think it was the third day I glassed some elk up that were, 10 miles away probably.
Yeah.
In a spot that was misery to try and get to. But luckily the guys that were in my tent with me, at the camp, we had all brought stuff to spike camp out.
Yeah.
So glassed those elk up, found them, figured out a route up there. And then for the last 4 days, we just went up, camp on our back, and camped for the last three nights of the trip.
Okay. So this was not just an outfitted hunt. This was an education type thing as well. Was this sponsored through anybody, or was this just what this outfitter did?
It's just what this outfitter does. So it's process-based hunter. Mm-hmm. It was actually kind of cool when we first got there, the first guy that I heard, I recognized his voice and I'm like, how do I know someone here? Turns out Ron Spomer was one of the guides.
And who's he?
So he's been an outdoor writer kind of forever. He does a lot of stuff on Western Big Game.
He
talks a lot about rifle hunting.
Yep.
If you would see a picture of him, you'd be like, oh, that's Ron. It was cool to see him, but yeah, that's kind of their thing where it's getting people from, when you go, you're at zero, it's trying to get you to that year three or four experience within 1 year.
Yeah. Yeah. That'd be nice. The learning curves out west suck, dude. Especially.
They're terrible.
Yeah. My first elk hunt was me just looking at elk at 5 miles away, where if I even wanted to get a shot at them, I had to drop down or go up 800 feet, drop down 1,000 feet, and then go back up another 1,000 feet. And right now there's probably some guy out west going, that's nothing, dude. Right?
Yeah. That's nothing. Just what we do here.
Yeah, exactly. But I was wearing steel toed work boots my first elk hunt, and I was not in shape, and everything sucked about it. And so I had to prepare kind of like you for those next trips that I took. But, so where were these other guys from? Was this a trip that you went out there with other people with, or was this solo? And then you just met up with these dudes there.
Yep. So it was just solo. I didn't have anybody else that could take the time off or had the ability to do an elk hunt. So I just signed up for myself. I flew out to Utah. Yeah. Rented a Jeep Gladiator and drove out.
Nice. Cool.
Yeah. It was an interesting way of doing things. I will say that.
Yeah. And so what happened in those last, 3 days? Did you even get close to elk at all on these trips?
Yeah. So the first night we got up there, just got camp set up. We actually had a black bear walk through camp while we were setting it up. Nice. So that was kind of fun. Bear season wasn't open yet. It opened September 1st last year. So yeah. We didn't have a bear tag, but that's also when I realized I was the dumbest person in camp. Cause we all pack up there and the bear walks through and I knocked an arrow immediately. And the other two guys I was with both drew their sidearms. And I'm like, right. That's why we brought these, actually.
I'm going to just shoot this bear. If he attacks me, I'm going to shoot him with my bow. Guys, watch out.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, right. I brought a 10 mil for a reason.
Yeah. Right.
The second day we had found some elk. So we split up and they were down in the bottom of this valley. They were actually feeding out on the private, but bedding up in the public land. So we'd seen them in the private in the morning. And then went in the afternoon. And so I went over the next ridge and was going to try and cut them off before they got back to that public. The other two guys went down the other drainage so that if I spooked them, they would go up towards them. If they spooked them, they'd go down towards me.
Yeah.
Seemed like an awesome plan. But I got about halfway to the pinch point that I wanted to be in, got up on top of the ridge and I glassed down and the elk were right underneath me.
Yeah.
When I ranged him, it said 93 yards, but I was, 150 feet above him.
Yep.
So it's like, well, I'm just going to keep going down into this bottom, got down to the bottom, and they had gotten spooked from somebody else, and they just shot right back up the drainage that they were in.
Yeah.
So that was as close as we got to him that day. Okay. Then next day, we had found some more and just didn't get a shot. One of the guys I was with got to about 50 yards, but it took off and just never had a good opportunity on it.
Yeah. How were you getting busted? Were they seeing you? Were they smelling you? Were they hearing you?
I think the first night they heard us.
Yeah.
Just because, I mean, it's where we were was super, super, super steep and rocky. I don't know if you've ever been in Utah, but the pictures are exactly what it's like. I mean, it's just broken up shale and rock cliffs everywhere. So it's super noisy trying to get down these drainages. So I think they were hearing us. And then the other ones, I'm pretty sure they smelled me and one of the other guys, and then just bolted out past the third guy I was with.
Gotcha. Gotcha. And was that kind of like the big hurdle was getting with this archery tag, getting within shooting range of them in this environment?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty open where we were hunting, and anywhere that it wasn't pretty open was just blowdown after blowdown.
Yeah.
So, yeah, trying to get in on them was brutal. I mean, if we were out there with a rifle tag, we would have all shot elk pretty easily.
Gotcha.
But, yeah, just trying to trick their nose doesn't work, as we all know.
What about the time of year? So you said you went out, was it the last week in August or the third week in August?
Last week of August.
Okay. And what were they doing? Were they even bugling at all? Were they talking to each other? Were they just dead quiet?
I heard one bugle the entire time I was out there. So it was all glassing, just trying to find them that way. So you're, glassing the big openings and just trying to locate them.
Were you guys trying to call them at all?
Hmm?
Were you guys trying to call them at all?
Just cow calling.
Yeah.
I threw a few bugles out in the mornings just to see if I could strike something up. But throughout the day, it was just cow calls once we had located something and trying to get in on them that way. But
it
was an interesting week for Utah because when you think about hunting arid deserts, you don't think that it's going to rain 6 of the 7 days that you're there.
Oh, boy.
But that's exactly what ended up happening to us. So the first day, we actually couldn't get to our camp because there was a mudslide that had gone through and covered the road. Generally you're out there and you're focusing on water holes.
Yeah.
But when it's raining all day, every day, they just weren't going to water. So we were having to do a lot more glassing, a lot more hiking, a lot more looking.
Yeah. How much of that time then, because of the rain, was spent in the tent or back at camp because you, like, it was just, they're probably bedded down and the only thing you're going to do out there is get soaked.
Yeah. I mean, the first few days when we were in the base camp still, a lot of it was spent at base camp, just going over maps and, talking about different scenarios. But when we spike camped, it doesn't matter. We're already wet. there was no way to dry off. I mean, my spike camp was just a sleeping pad and an Argali tarp.
Yeah. Like,
that's all I brought up on the mountain. I didn't want to overload myself with extra stuff. The second I blew up my pad, laid it down, laid on it, it popped. So I spent three nights just laying on the ground in just pure misery, soaking wet and sleeping on rocks.
Holy shit. Like, that would suck, dude.
Yeah, it was brutal.
So your sleeping bag was wet?
Sleeping bag was wet. All your clothes are wet.
And you just toughed it out.
I'm not walking back to the truck. You know, where we were hunting, we parked at 7,200 feet, and where we camped was 9,000.
Okay. So then what did you do? Like, during the day, unzip your sleeping bag and hang it up to try to get it to dry, and then it didn't dry because it rained all the time, so you just came back to a wet sleeping bag?
Yep.
Oh, yep.
Luckily, you know, it's Utah. I mean, it was 60 at night.
Okay.
So you weren't freezing to death, but yeah, I mean, it was uncomfortable the entire time. But looking back on it, I mean, I had a great trip.
Yeah. I don't know, dude. I'm kind of a sissy when it comes to that stuff. Like, getting wet, like, I'm okay if it's like a day, but when it comes to nighttime and being wet all night and I know that there was a little bit of an unforeseen circumstance there with the sleeping pad, but my first elk hunting trip to Idaho was I borrowed a tent from a buddy, and that tent was not waterproofed. Something happened to it. I'm not sure. And I woke up in the middle of the night with about this much water. I'm going to say half inch of water in the bottom of my tent. And so luckily I was on a sleeping pad that kept most of my stuff up. But I had to go to the guy that I was with and just be like, dude, can I get into your tent just for tonight? Like, and he was okay with it, 'cause he had some extra room. And, but then I had to go back down the mountain the next day to go buy a tent, a very overpriced tent, in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And dude, it was absolutely horrible. It was a very bad experience. So, but yeah, I learned a lot.
Yeah, you learn those lessons. I think one of the biggest takeaways that I had from spiking for a few days is, oh my God, do I overpack for these trips? Mm-hmm. You know, you bring so much stuff. You got 5 pairs of pants and, you know, 30 different layers with you and all this crap. And then, like, then you go up the mountain and you have a shirt and your puffies and a pair of pants. And that's literally all you really need.
Yeah. But that's the crazy part, dude, is you don't know. Because when I was hunting in Colorado, I'll use 2 examples. Colorado. I hunted in Colorado for, it was like 6 days. The first 2 days when we were up there was 85 degrees at 11,000 feet. Hot as shit, you know, like, and then it dropped down to like 25 degrees in a matter of 40 minutes. It started to snow and all of this crazy shit and rain heavy. And then the temperature dropped for the next handful of days down into the 40s. So it was a 40 degree temperature swing. And I went from just wearing a t-shirt all day to even in the, you know, in the middle of the, or in the mornings walking up. And I wish I would have packed more clothes for the following couple days when it was 40 degrees. 'Cause when we stopped to glass or stopped to do a calling sequence, dude, I needed my puffies and I needed all that stuff. And we did get wet and it did make me shiver, a lot. And the other example was, South Dakota. I'm literally watching this cold front move in and I'm going, okay, the deer are going to be moving when this cold front comes in. And it was probably 80 degrees. We're sitting on a knob glassing the last hour of light. Storm comes in, 30 degrees, starts snowing. And we're like, dude, how are we going to get out of here? Right? 'Cause it was mud road, starts to rain. And I'm starting to shiver because I'm just wearing a long sleeve t-shirt. And so overpacking sucks until you actually need some of that additional gear for the, I don't know how you would say this, the worst possible outcomes, you know, like, hey, maybe I won't take as much water this year. And then guess what? It's 90 degrees outside and you wish you had more water. Maybe I won't pack this extra base layer until you need that extra base layer. You know what I mean? And so there is an element of trying to tough it out that people probably don't understand that.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to happen. We got lucky, honestly, that it rained because none of us packed enough water.
Yeah.
Like, we didn't anticipate how tough the hike was going to be to get up there. And if it wasn't for it raining and collecting rainwater off the tents, like, we would have been dead by day three.
Yeah. Dude, that's crazy. You were collecting rainwater off the tents.
Yep.
Efficient. I like it. I like it.
It's efficient. You don't have to worry about, you know, using a SteriPen or filtering it. Like, it's just coming straight off the tent, right into an Nalgene, and it just kept going. But
good to go. Love it.
That was another thing that I didn't anticipate was, you know, I had brought freeze dry with me for all my meals. And like, but now I got to use all my water to cook. Where the other guys with me, you know, they had like the Spam singles and, you know, nuts and jerky and everything with them.
Yep.
I'm like, boy, I wish that I didn't have to use an entire Nalgene of water that I carried up here just to try and eat dinner every night.
Yeah. Yeah. I did that too. When I did a spike camp, we had to go get water every day. And when I was in South Dakota, I ran out of water and then my pump, my filter, water filter pump broke. And I had to basically just dip water into this mud hole, dip my Nalgene bottle into this mud hole to get water because it was so dry. And instead of pumping it, I just used those pills that dissolve. Mm-hmm. And, you know, 45 minutes, you have to wait 45 minutes before you can drink it. And I, dude, that water tasted like shit. I mean, it was gritty from all the sand that was in it. And I was, but I needed something to cook my food at night because I didn't, you know, I brought my good water with me every day to drink, but then the shitty water that I got from there was what I boiled to cook with at night. So
yeah, you're passing it through a sock to try and get the grit out.
Boy, this water tastes like feet, dude.
Yeah. Yeah. This is absolutely horrible.
What was the biggest takeaway from this elk hunt that you went on? And were you successful at all? Did you even get a shot opportunity?
No shot opportunities. I think my biggest takeaway overall is that I don't know how to e-scout for elk.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, because leading up to the hunt, you know, we probably had 2 months. And I mean, I dropped 100 waypoints on Onyx for stuff that looked good. And I mean, I don't think that I dropped a waypoint within 5 miles of where we saw anything. Right. It was, you know, for me at home, at least, you know, we're looking for such micro parts of these areas that we're hunting. You know, 5 oak trees can be the best thing in a 200 acre or 1,000 acre area, where out there, like, I was putting waypoints on these little feeding areas or these little benches. And it's like, oh, well, 2 elk will eat all the grass in that feeding area in one day and not be there the rest of the year.
Yeah.
Or it's, man, like, you actually need to look for big, giant areas and, like, understanding that, yeah, that elk will walk 5 miles if they want to that day in the mountains.
Yeah.
Or, like, it was eye-opening for how I need to start looking at the landscape out there.
Yeah, man, that scouting is so difficult out west because, I mean, are there cattle there? Has it been burnt? Is the satellite imagery up to date? How many people are going to be there? So many things. Is it dry? How much snow did they have in the winter? Is it going to be wet in these creeks? Are these creeks dry? Like, all these things matter out west. And because you're not there or I'm not there, then we come in severely handicapped because everything at that point has to be done on the, you know, in the moment, and preparing for it is very difficult.
Yeah. You know, you feel so prepared when you've scoured a map forever and, like, you have all these different plans and preconceived notions of, like, how the hunt's going to go. And you get there and you're like, throw everything out the window.
Yep.
Like, I just need to go somewhere high and look around.
Exactly. Exactly. Yep. Absolutely. Well, I tell you what, dude, has this fired you up for more elk hunts? Or, like, is this something you're going to try to do every year now or every other year? What's the case?
I would like to say every year. It'll probably be every other year. Right now, I think me and a buddy are planning on Montana next year.
Outfitter again?
Nope. That'll just be a DIY. I don't plan on doing any more outfitters. unless I draw crazy tags in like Wyoming where you need to have an outfitter if you want to hunt wilderness and stuff like that. You know, so I might end up doing some stuff like that out there, but I have all the gear now to be able to do it myself. So I would like to do it that way. But I mean, I've got points all over the West now. So if I can swing it, it'll be an every year thing.
Yeah. Gotcha. Gotcha. Well, my friend, you need to sell a lot more roofs, to make this little obsession of ours, you know, I have a ton of points for Wyoming, but I also know how much it's going to cost to go out there. Am I going to use an outfitter? Am I going to, you know, do a DIY public deal? How many days am I going to stay out there? And all that, every day equals dollars out there, you know, and time and things like that. So, I got to make sure that all things are good here at home. And then also I got to make sure that I have enough money to, you know, did I make enough money this year to do that? So all things that need to be thought about when we do that. So I really appreciate you taking time out of your day, man. Thank you very much for sharing your insight and your stories, your Western hunting stories. Good luck this upcoming season with whatever it is you do. I hope you slay and you run into something big, dude.
Yeah. Thanks, Dan. It was nice to talk to you.